This is Culturetopia, your weekly dose of culture love from your friends at National Public Radio. I am Netta Ulibi, reporter for NPR's Arts Desk.
And I'm Tanya Ballard Brown, an editor for NPR.org and crazy singer person.
Welcome to Culturetopia. Just a reminder, you can subscribe to this podcast at npr.org/culturetopia if you haven't already done so. This week,
a look at a new collection of children's poetry from Mary Poppins herself, Julie Andrews.
And we've got a conversation with hipster A-list writer Dave Eggers. He talks about writing the screen adaptation of Where the Wild Things Are. And we've got rapper Bun B paying tribute to one of his favorite albums. But first,
if you watch Project Runway or any other design-oriented reality show, you'll hear the word modern used over and over and over again. But in the context of reality TV, the word is often misapplied. Here's Netta with the story.
In the world of art and design, modern means something very specific, a movement that peaked in the early 20th century. Modern means Schoenberg, or Stravinsky, or Picasso. It means daring experimental writers, Ezra Pound or Gertrude Stein. It means Frank Lloyd Wright sweeping out the overstuffed and fusty in favor of long, clean lines. It does not mean a tiki bar put together for $100 on the HGTV show Design Star.
We were going for a tropical oasis, zen modern feel.
I don't see the zen.
I do cringe a little bit, just because, to put it in a nutshell, the word modern really refers to something having to do with the early 20th century.
Douglas Mao is a modernism expert. He says these reality show judges tend to say modern when they mean contemporary. Contemporary means current. Modernism means
a certain kind of difficulty, a certain kind of challenge, a certain kind of deep interest in originality and not repeating the same old stuff.
And I love that you made it modern in a way, like something that I haven't seen before.
Project Runway's Heidi Klum is not necessarily wrong when she describes a dress as modern. She means it's fresh and bold. What's irritating to Mao is when lazy designers just toss out modern when they mean not ugly. Like in the show The Unsellables on HGTV.
What we need to do to this house is give it better flow, make it look lived in, loved in, more modern, so it's going to appeal to a young, funky person like you.
Sure. In most contexts, modern can mean contemporary. But it's weird to hear them being used interchangeably by people who've presumably studied the history of art and design.
We've repositioned two of Simone's own sofas to create a modern seating area.
Here's why modern is so ubiquitous. Douglas Mao says it's because modern never really goes out of style. But he thinks contemporary already has.
Contemporary also, in the world of fashion, I think, has a slightly outdated quality. It has a certain down-market flavor, I think, right? Contemporary casuals and so on.
Ultimately, says Mao, judges on shows like Project Runway may need a brand new word.
If I were Nina Garcia, that's a sentence I've never uttered before, I might sometimes just say new, surprising, exciting, not seen before. I don't know, but I don't think there's one word that's the right word.
Until that word comes along, we're just going to have to live with modern basically meaning good on reality television. Netta Ulibi, NPR News. Tanya, I just wanted to tell this little story about how when I did this piece with my editor, Sarah Saracen, we were expecting tons of angry letters from listeners about how we were being overly nitpicky about the word modern and people should be able to use it in whatever ways. And the medievalists would write in and say, oh, it's actually a word that's been around, you know, forever, which it has. We were just using it very specifically about this design, in this design context. We got tons of fan letters. We could...
Because that's the modern way.
I guess so. I couldn't believe it. Up next, we've got a story about Julie Andrews, whose almost perfect singing voice was damaged in surgery. But she spoke to us about a new collection of children's poetry she put together with her daughter, Emma Walton Hamilton. Andrew told NPR's Lynn Neary that poetry has long played an important role in her family.
When Julie Andrews and her daughter started to think about which poems to include in this collection, a couple of obvious ones came to mind, Sea Fever and Cargoes by John Masefield, because they were among the first poems Andrews had memorized as a child. And then there was
A.A. Milne's The King's Breakfast, which is that charming poem, The King Asked the Queen and the Queen Asked the Dairymaid. could we have some butter for the royal slice of bread? And, of course, it's a wonderful poem to read to children. That had to be in the book. And so it was joint favourites, personal favourites. Of course, once we started looking, we discovered 100 new favourites.
This one is a favourite from both of our childhoods.
So we're going to read it together. And it's called The King's Breakfast by A.A. Milne. I'll start. The king asked the queen, and the queen asked the dairymaid,
"Could we have some butter for the royal slice of bread?"
The queen asked the dairymaid. The dairymaid said,
"Certainly, I'll go and tell the cow now before she goes to bed."
The dairymaid, she curtsied and went and told the Alderney,
"Don't forget the butter for the royal slice of bread."
Andrews and Walton Hamilton even included a few of their own poems, as well as some by Andrew's father and grandfather. Andrew says poetry has always been a family affair. Her own parents were divorced, but when she visited her dad, he would always read poetry to her.
He actually loved to commit poems to memory because he felt that on a walk, if he needed to talk to himself or never be lonely or flex his brain, he could recite a poem. And he had many committed to memory.
And your father's favorite poem is Loveliest of Trees, which, of course, is included in this book. Do you have it memorized by any chance?
Not all of it, but you can prompt me. It's by A.E. Housman.
Right.
And it is one of my favorites, too. Loveliest of Trees. The cherry now is hung with bloom along the bough, and goes about the woodland ride, wearing white for Eastertide. And here's where I get a little lost. Anyway, eventually it ends up by saying, "About the woodlands I will go, to see the cherry hung with snow."
The collection also includes the lyrics of songwriters like Johnny Mercer, Stephen Sondheim, and Rodgers and Hammerstein.
For me, whenever I choose a song to sing, it's about the lyric first. You'd think, of course, it's about the melody, that's a given. But really, I'm no good at singing a song unless it has a good lyric. I mean, my favourite things from The Sound of Music is really a poem.
Raindrops on roses and whiskers on kittens, bright copper kettles and warm woolen mittens, brown paper packages tied up with strings. These are a few of my favourite things.
Then there's a glorious lyric by Ira Gershwin to a song called My Ship. And that is really, I think it's almost one of my favorite songs, but it is because the words are so beautiful.
My ship has sails that are made of silk. The decks are trimmed with gold.
The loss of her singing voice more than 10 years ago was devastating for Andrews, but since then she's become famous with a whole new generation, taking on parts in films like The Princess Diaries and Shrek 2 and 3. And while nothing will ever replace her singing, Andrews says reading poetry out loud comes close.
It certainly gives me a satisfaction, and to bring my own take to the reading of each poem is great fun. But, yeah, I do hear the music, and there's rhythms and movement and words that are important. It's great fun to read them.
Andrews hopes this collection of favorite poems, family poems, and memorable lyrics will lead others to discover the joy of reading aloud to children. Poetry may seem intimidating, she says, but mostly it's a way to connect with the people you love. Lynn Neary, NPR News, Washington.
Tanya, I hear that you connect with the people you love by singing as well as by online editing. Do you have a Julie Andrews song that you wouldn't mind sharing?
I do like the Lonely Goat Herd. High on a hill with a lonely goat herd, lady, lady, lady. Can't outdo Julie, though. Can't outdo Julie.
I think you give her a run for her money. Thank you. That was transporting. And we've got a story next that takes us far, far away.
In a country that was once isolated, what happens in the outside world is now finding its way to China's culture, which creates opportunities for many Chinese to use their gut instinct. NPR's Anthony Kuhn has the story of a young man from northern China who made it to the top of his profession, one that would have been banned a generation ago.
At his self-titled Chinese celebrity Guo Wei Belly Dancing Club, Guo Wei is instructing his students in the use of a veil. It's an indispensable tool in a belly dancer's kit, he tells them. In under 30 years, Guo Wei has gone from an average childhood in the northern industrial city of Handan to becoming a leading center of China's navel gazing. Today, mostly co-eds and white-collar young women and the occasional young man pay more than $700 a year to twirl their exposed midriffs in Guo's Middle Eastern-themed studios. Guo Wei's parents divorced when he was young and he was left to fend for himself. His wanderings took him from a job as a gym coach in Beijing to Cairo, Egypt in 2004. He took up belly dancing there with a teacher who he was surprised to learn was named Mohammed.
I thought it was strange that he was a male teacher. I had wanted to study with a woman because I thought women made better belly dancers, but men are more careful teachers. Besides, women like male teachers better.
Hu Lingna agrees with that. The demure young woman from Shanghai started as Guo's student and is now a fellow belly dance teacher at his school.
I found him on the internet, and at first I thought it was very odd. But then I saw him dance. He was just so natural, more feminine than a woman, and very attractive. There was nothing more to consider, so I just came here.
Guo's lithe torso undulates across Chinese stages and television screens with increasing frequency. A generation ago, his performances would have been banned as spiritual pollution or bourgeois decadence. Guo claims some recent success in China in winning acceptance for belly dancing, or as it's rendered in Mandarin, du pi wu.
At first, some folks were simply attracted by the novelty of something they had never seen before. Others, as soon as they heard I was a male dancer, had no interest in watching. They just weren't able to accept it.
There's hardly a cultural endeavor where China is not making its mark these days. Guo Wei is now China's ambassador to the world of belly dancing, shaking it with Egyptians, Europeans, and Americans at international festivals. The enterprising Guo is always on the lookout for the next exotic cultural import. Further cementing his role as impresario of abdominal gyrations, he's just unveiled the Guo Wei School of Hula Skirt Dancing. Anthony Kuhn, NPR News, Beijing.
Author Dave Eggers has been shaking it in the literary world ever since his first novel won the Pulitzer Prize. These days, though, he seems to be transitioning to film. He wrote the screenplay for this summer's romantic comedy, Away We Go. And with director Spike Jonze, he adapted Where the Wild Things Are. Eggers spoke with NPR's Melissa Block about the writing process. He said Maurice Sendak approved of their dark take on his classic children's book.
Well, he loves that. He loves that it's scary, that there's a natural child's fascination with morbidity and danger and darkness. And it's true. And every little kid I've ever known, they want to talk about the dead bird that they found or, you know, the roadkill or whatever they see on a daily basis. Like, it's not something that they're afraid to talk about. And so he really, all of his books, you know, he writes books about childhood, but not necessarily for children. Like, I don't think that he thinks, well, okay, what would a child like? Or what does a child psychologist say I should write in this book? Or what will teach a valuable, you know, lesson? I think it comes from somewhere much deeper and from the subconscious or something even primal or dreamlike in his work. And he really wanted something that, I say, refanged the book and made it kind of strange and dangerous again. And that's what he held us to continuously. It's like, keep it weird and maybe a little scary here and there.
I want to talk to you about the process of writing with Spike Jonze. He moved, I think, up to San Francisco, where you lived, to work on this, right?
Yeah, he rented a place in the Castro, and we would sit every day, you know, and talk. I mean, for every 8 hours that we would be there, and we would get at least 10 or 15 minutes of work done. So it was really
that's a pretty good ratio.
Super efficient. No, it wasn't at all, but we had a lot of sort of figuring things out to do and talking it through and, you know, spending a lot of time talking. So those first 4 months, I think, that Spike was living in San Francisco, we ended up with a draft, but it wasn't a straight route. It was very meandering and circuitous and sort of getting at the heart of our respective childhoods and what a movie like this should be.
Would there be props to sort of transport you back to being a 9-year-old kid?
Yeah. Well, we plastered pages from the book all over the room. So we always knew who we were talking about. And then as we came up with characters, we would, you know, put that Wild Thing's name on a post-it and fleshed out their personalities. But in terms of other props, maybe there was always a skateboard on hand that would, whoever wasn't typing would be skateboarding around the house in a circle. I don't know, maybe we got our brains working, or maybe it was just another distraction.
So a skateboard.
Yeah, that's the only prop I can think of. I mean, Spike has a BB gun in his house that he periodically would shoot me with.
Come on.
No, that's true. Yeah, no, he's a very juvenile guy and really annoying in that way if you have a friend that ever shoots you. Yeah.
Do you think he was trying to get you into the spirit of, you know, of Max, of sort of the Wild Thing, and what
no.
better way to do it than with a BB gun? Or do you think
no,
he just
I think
to,
he
like,
shoots
shoot
most
people?
Of his guests. I think he does. I don't think it was thought through that to that extent. I think that most people that spend some time at his house get shot at some point. So all of your listeners will also know to be prepared to be shot.
Yeah, this is a public service we're doing right
exactly.
now.
Exactly. National Public Service Radio.
You can hear the full interview at npr.org/culturetopia.
Rap music may have started in the Bronx, but in recent years, the South and deep bass lines have taken over the airwaves. We're running a series right now called You Must Hear This, in which musicians talk about a piece of music they love. Here is some early Southern rap from the group that coined the term Dirty South. Bun B, of the Grammy-nominated rap group UGK, says that Goody Mob's 1995 debut album, Soul Food, still inspires his life and music.
One, to the two, the three, the four, them dirty red dogs done hit the door when they got everybody on their hands.
I made a very real connection with that album.
Yeah, the Cobras got the boys on the lawn in back. Give Paula that Miss Ashley said they didn't get trapped behind the black, behind the green, behind the red tent. Dealers breaking off that blower for them wood chips. A lot of faces ain't around, a lot of folks got shot.
At the very least, the music was extremely entertaining. It was extremely enjoyable. But if you really got into listening to the wordplay and the lyricism.
See, never did I think when I got grown that some peewee sacks up and untook this town. See, life's a trick, then you figure out why you really got dropped in the dirty side.
See, in the third grade, this is what you told. You was bought, you was sold.
Right. Now they saying Juice left some heads cracked. I bet you Jed Clampett wanted money back. See, East Point, Atlanta through this roadblock. Tell my all this blow traffic got to stop. So the big time players all jump Freeman way. Had to find themselves another back street to take.
It really was trying to make you understand, okay, look, the way they got you locked down in your hood is the way they've always had us locked down in society. You actually took something home after you finished dancing. You actually learned something. And there's not a lot of people that can say they can do that in the course of a dance song. But I think Goody Mob are great examples of that.
My old boy from the point, but I'm from Southwest. And every now and then I get put to the test. But I can't be stopped, cause I gotta come to. Ain't got no gun, but I got my crew. Didn't come for no beef, cause I don't eat steak. I gotta play the soul food.
Soul food is gut food, you know what I'm saying? It's food that sticks to you.
Daddy put the hot grits on my chest in the morning. When I was sick, Mary had the hot soup. Boiling, didn't know why, but it felt so good. Like some waffles in the morning, headed back to the woods. Now I'm full as a tick, got some soul on blast and a cassette. Food for my brain and haven't stopped learning yet.
We as Southern musicians and Southern artists, I think, we were all raised on a lot of rhythm and blues and soul music, and we take a lot of those influences and put it into our music. So even though we may be rapping sometimes about cars, there's a lot of times where we talk about real life things.
Everything that I did, different things I was told, just ended up being food for my soul.
Make it your soul food. Well, good old-fashioned soul food. All
right. So if you want music that just not being made to get your money, but music that's being made to really inspire you, then Soul Food is that out.
That's it for this week.
You can find links to all the stories we have today and subscribe to this podcast at npr.org/culturetopia. I'm Tanya Ballard Brown.
And I'm Netta Ulaby. Thanks for listening to Culturetopia. So long.
Looking for a little soul food.
Make it your soul food. Well then, good old fashioned soul food.